Hello. Welcome, everyone, to the Hammer Museum. Welcome to all of you who are in the annex as well and out in the courtyard. We are way full past our capacity, so we're accommodating as many people as we can by having audio of this program out in the courtyard as well as our overflow space. I'm Claudia Bester. I'm the Director of Public Programs. I'm very pleased to welcome you all to today's discussion on the future of food with Ignacio Chapella, Derek Jensen, and Vandana Shiva. Before we get started, I'd like to remind you all to please silence your cell phones, and video recording, audio recording, photography are not permitted in the theater, but we will be posting this entire program on our website following the show. I also want to quickly mention some upcoming Hammer programs you might be interested in. The next Hammer Forum takes place on November 19th, and we're going to have three scholars from UC San Diego coming to examine China's domestic challenges, which are especially related tangentially to today's program in that there's a growing environmental movement in China because of the extreme pollution problems they're having there. And that's actually putting a lot of pressure on the Chinese government. So it's going to be a very interesting discussion. In December, the Hammer Forum is going to focus on the current political climate in Venezuela. And then in January, we're going to examine internet privacy with Julia Angwin, who's the author of Dragnet Nation. So if you want to receive reminder emails about these upcoming events and other ones, there's a sign-up sheet in the lobby that you can put your name down and we'll send you information. You can also always find out more on our website. The talk that we had here last month by Naomi Klein, as well as the Hammer Forum on Climate Change that we did on October 23rd, both of those are podcast in video on the Hammer website, as well as on Vimeo and YouTube. So on to our discussion. Today's program is co-presented with the Friends of Navdanya, an Ashe restaurant, and I want to especially thank Dr. Kumkum Basin and Joanna Moore, without whom today would not have been possible. The future of the planet and people is intimately linked to the future of food. All humans must eat, and industrial agriculture has a massive impact on the Earth's ecosystems and on human health. As society becomes more aware of the true cost of industrial agriculture, including GMOs, there's an attempt by the chemical industry to use legal maneuvering through patents and seed laws to prevent farmers from having the freedom to save and exchange seeds, and also legal maneuvering to prevent consumers from having the freedom to choose what they eat by properly labeling foods in a consumer-friendly and factual way. Here in California and also in Washington State, attempts to pass labeling laws were blocked, and the corporations are now also challenging Vermont's labeling laws. So today we have three leading advocates for the growing movement for food democracy. Ignacio Chapella is a microbial ecologist and mycologist at UC Berkeley. He's best known for a controversial paper in Nature on the flow of transgenes into wild maize populations. He's also an outspoken critic of the University of California's ties to the biotechnology industry and an activist on behalf of the rights of indigenous people. Writer and activist Derek Jensen has been discussing the inherent destructiveness of industrial civilization for decades. He's the author of 20 books, including Endgame and A Language Older Than Words. He holds a degree in creative writing from Eastern Washington University, a degree in mineral engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines, and yes, that's mines, not mimes. I had to check. And he's taught at Eastern Washington University and Pelican Bay State Prison, and has been called the philosopher poet of the environmental movement. Dr. Vandana Shiva is a physicist, ecologist, activist, and the founder and director of Navdanya International, an international movement to protect the diversity and integrity of living resources and to promote organic farming and fair trade. Dr. Shiva also serves as a visionary leader and for various governments across the globe. As one example, she's assisting the government of Bhutan to develop a comprehensive organic agriculture system for that country. In addition to her political experience, Dr. Shiva contributes to numerous international food and agriculture, women's rights, and social justice movements. She's on the board of directors of the International Forum on Globalization, founding chair of the Tuscany Government's Commission on the Future of Food, a counselor of the World Future Council, and vice president of Slow Food, among many other organizations. Dr. Shiva is also a prolific author. A few of her key publications include Soil, Not Oil, Monocultures of the Mind, The Violence of the Green Revolution, and Staying Alive, Women, Ecology, and Development. And we'll have some of the books by Dr. Shiva and Derek Jensen available in our courtyard for sale following this program. And Dr. Shiva and Derek Jensen have said they'd be willing to sign some books. So come join us for that after the discussion. And now, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ignacio Chapela, Derek Jensen, and Vandana Shiva.
So is this on? Can you hear me? So before we start, I would like to thank Kumkum and Joanna, can't read my own handwriting, and the Human Museum, the Hammer Museum.
That is deliberate.
Well, there's got to be something in there about Human Museum, too. We can work that in. So the only measure by which we will be judged by the people who come after is going to be the health of the land. They're not going to really care whether we wrote a whole bunch of books or whether we tried really hard or whether we did great activism or whether we gave talks or went to talks or recycled or voted Democrat, Republican, Green, or fascist in India, or fascist in the United States. They're not going to really care. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water and whether the land will provide them with food. And it seems to me that's the core of what we're talking about today. And those of you who know my work will not be surprised to learn that I misunderstood what this talk was supposed to be about. And so I prepared a different talk, which I'm going to give anyway. Instead of the future of food, at least it's related. We're going to talk about football. I thought we were talking about the ethics of GMOs, which really sort of ties in, obviously. And so, you know, there's a lot we can talk about with the ethics of GMOs. There's the dreadful ethics of converting everything on the planet to human use, and the even more dreadful ethics of converting everything on the planet to profit. And there's the ethics of doing massive open-air experiments that have the potential to do great harm to the world. That's our only home. And, of course, that is what this culture does. That's massive deforestation. That's wetlands, destroying wetlands. That's the murder of the oceans. That's pesticides. That's global warming. That's plastics. All these are massive open-air experiments in which the harm comes not primarily to those who do the experiments but to the real world. So we can also talk about the ethics of destroying local autonomy, and that's also what this culture does. And there's the ethics of destroying local food autonomy, and there's the ethics of making people dependent on large corporations and how that creates a pliable workforce. It's like John Mohawk used to say, there's no sovereignty without food sovereignty. And the very first cities had walls not around the outside but around the granaries, because if the king can control access to food, he's got a workforce. He's got a workforce. And the same was true. There's a great line, a great letter written by an 1830s pro-slavery philosopher to his northern abolitionist buddy. This is back in the 1830s. He was saying that, you know, if we could change land ownership conditions, we would give up our slaves immediately, because there are land ownership conditions in which it is in the capitalist best interest to own slaves, and there's land ownership conditions in which it is in the capitalist best interest to not own them. And it's very simple. If there's a lot of land and not many people, that means that people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency. And the only way you can get them to work for you is the point of a gun. On the other hand, if you have a lot of people and not much land, that means people don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food self-sufficiency, which means if they don't work for you, they starve. And so if you have urban conditions, that it is actually in the capitalist's best interest to not own the slaves. because they're a huge capital expense. And so that ties into this too, because we're talking about food self-sufficiency, and I'll leave that to people who have a much better understanding than I to discuss that in a little while. But anyway, so, oh, that's also why the laws of apartheid were written. They were written because they needed workers for the mines, but the local people were not in the wage economy. And they were subsistence farmers and subsistence cattle raisers. And so how are you going to get these people to work in mines? So what they did is they instituted poll taxes, hut taxes, dog taxes, so that people would have to have cash, which means they have to go to work in the mines, because before that they were living completely without money in local autonomous communities. And so that's how they destroyed apartheid. Yeah, we can talk about the racism that was central to it all, but one of the fundamental driver was getting labor. But actually, that's not what I want to talk about. So there's also, we can talk about the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle holds that if there is a chance that what you're going to do is going to harm either the natural world or the public at large, that you err on the side of caution, that you don't do something until you have shown by a preponderance of evidence that it's safe. And on the other hand, we have the opposite. Actually, that's not true. This culture does have a precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle in place is that before you can stop some horrible activity, you have to show that it's not going to harm profits. And so what's really protected in this culture is profits. And, you know, but that's all okay, really, because all these costs are paid by the public and the natural world, and fuck them, right? And that means they're not really costs. Just the other day, I read an article that said, quote, "There are no costs associated with solar photovoltaics." Really? The 18-square-mile open-pit rare earth mine in China that has made the surrounding soil so toxic that vegetables will no longer grow is not a cost? But that's how it always goes. I mean, this culture is based on privatizing profits and externalizing costs, which is just a fancy way of saying theft and murder. But I don't want to talk about that either. So something else we could talk about would be the relationship between GMOs and the violation imperatives that's at the core of patriarchy. Patriarchy is based on the notion, and supremacism is based on the notion that my group is superior, which frankly makes sense to me. It's based on finding identifiable others who are readily identifiable, and then declaring them to be inferior. So humans are a sexually dimorphic species. So women are identifiably different in general than men, and you want to make sure also socially to make them different, to make it so they're identifiably different. And then you find this other, and then you exploit them based on that otherness. And this is true for racism, that you find some identifiable difference. Somebody's skin color is different. Well, that means I can exploit them. Oh, for God's sake. In the 1830s, there were a lot of scientific rationales for slavery, and one of them was that the difference, the inches between an African man's penis and his navel is different than a white man's penis and his navel, according to the best scientific theory of the time. And so that's why you can enslave them. Okay. So the point is that you find some difference, and then you choose that difference, you use that difference as a reason to exploit them. Never mind, that doesn't make any sense. But the cool thing, or the important thing here, is that then your exploitation of them becomes a sign of your superiority over them. So this is why there are, 25% of all the women in this culture have been raped, and 19% have had to fend off rape attempts, is because every violation, every rape, is a validation of the superiority of the men from the patriarchal perspective. And the reason I bring all this up is because all these others are out there, and they're all then violable. And then it's even worse, because violation becomes not an action, but an identity. It's how you validate who you are. I'm writing a book right now on human supremacism and all the ways we humans tell that we're superior are all a bunch of crap. And we can talk about that later or not if you want. It doesn't matter. But the point is that the bottom line is always we're superior because we can kill them. We're superior because we can exploit them. We're superior than pigs because we can exploit pigs. Never mind, there's this image I can't get out of my head of a mother pig in one of those crates singing to her children. And, you know, who's the superior creature, you know? It's like they couldn't kill her love, but they can still violate her. And the reason, and because they can put her in a cage, that means they're superior. And so this this ends up, I mean, this is why, without this identification of others as inferior, without this violation, because it's identity, we are not. We're a void. And so we have to fill this void, fill it with validations of our superiority, fill it with violations, thus the rapes, thus the violation of every boundary set up by every indigenous culture, thus the extinctions, thus the insane belief in an economic system based on infinite growth, despite the fact that we live on a finite planet. I mean, that's a violation of that boundary. You know, the Earth has a boundary. You can only do so much. Well, fuck it. You know, we're going to have infinite growth on a finite planet. This is nonsense, of course. But there's one of the things, too, is I've heard it said that the real authorities of any culture, the unquestioned beliefs are the real authorities of any culture, which I think is one reason we're here, is to question some of those unquestioned beliefs. And so it's like infinite growth on a finite planet. You know, I understood that with stupid when I was 7 years old. And I think a lot of us do. And this is the reason also for the refusal to accept any limits on technological progress, which is more properly called technological escalation, as it really involves an escalation of the wielder's ability to control and violate at a distance, or on scientific knowledge, thus the sending of probes to penetrate the deepest folds of the ocean floor, thus the bombing of the moon, thus the violation down to even the level of genetic materials. You know, if jellyfish wanted to combine their genetic materials with pigs, they would find a way to have sex. But they don't. It's a forced violation on that genetic level. Everything's to be used. Everything's to be violated. It's even in our epistemology. Richard Dawkins, who I just can't stand. Richard Dawkins has this great line. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. You know, you flip a switch and the light goes on. That's how we know science works. But there's a really sneaky thing that has been sneaked in there, which is that what he's done is he has defined how we know something is true by our ability to dominate it. And think about this for a second. What if I put a hoop right here, and I take a gun, and I point this gun at you, and I say, on the count of three, you're going to jump through this hoop. On the count of three, she jumps through the hoop. What do you know? I'm a fucking genius. I just predicted what was going to happen and when, and it just happened. I made matter and energy jump through hoops on command. But don't you think it's possible that by pulling a gun on you and by forcing you to jump through a hoop, that I have destroyed any possibility of friendship between us? And so I see this on a larger scale, too. There are other ways to know. But I don't want to talk about any of that either. Okay, and so I'm going to finish up my introduction by talking about one more tiny topic, which is what I really want to talk about with GMOs is something that Lewis Mumford talked about, which is authoritarian and democratic technics. And a technic is the combination of the social structure and the technology. Technologies don't emerge in vacuums. It is the people who live here. Whose land are we on anyway? Do we know? Whose land is this? Did you say Chumash? Who? Wait, can like one person say one thing and somebody else say something else not at the same time? Because I'm hearing like Tongva Chigaba. So, well, we all agree that it's Arm and Hammer, but it's not really. Tongva? Okay. So the point is that the Tongva did not invent backhoes, not because they were too stupid to invent backhoes. The Tongva didn't invent backhoes because they had an entirely different set of social structures and social assumptions that would lead them. Like where I live, the Tala would live there. They still live there. And they lived there for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the myths of the Tala, they lived there since the beginning of time. In either case, a long time. And when the Europeans arrived there 180 years ago, the place was a paradise. And now the place is completely trashed. And the Tala did not invent backhoes either. What they did invent is technologies like salmon welcoming songs. That's an entirely different set of technologies that would come from a different mindset. So you have, okay, and then once you have a car, so a certain mindset would create a car, a certain culture, a certain set of social assumptions would create a car. And then once you have a car, it affects how you then perceive the world. So it's this mutually reinforcing set of circumstances or something. So it's like, I live 3 miles from the grocery store. I can go to the grocery store and I buy all the things I'm going to buy, and then I come home and I realize, oh shoot, I didn't buy any genetically modified organisms today. So I can go back to the store very easily because I need to get some of those because they're going to be really good for me. And on the other hand, if I didn't have a car, I would make damn sure I had a list. You know, it's like, so on even those small ways that technologies affect how we perceive the world. And so he then divided techniques. Do we understand what a technique is so far? It's a combination of technology and the mindset that both leads to it and emerges from it. And then he then divided techniques into democratic or authoritarian. And the distinction is really simple. It's that if it's something that leads to authoritarian power regimes and requires authoritarian power regimes, it's authoritarian techniques. A great example is pottery as a democratic technique. Anybody can find some mud. Anybody can make a pot. It's going to be a terrible pot, but you can make a pot. And likewise, bows and arrows. Democratic technique. Anybody can make a bow and arrow. Nobody can have a monopoly on bows and arrows. On the other hand, guns are an authoritarian technique. I'm not even talking about what you do with the bow and arrow. That's not important right this second. On the other hand, a gun, even if you have a gun, you still need gunpowder. You still need bullets, which means somebody somewhere else can control your use of the gun. You no longer have local autonomous control. And so cars, or solar photovoltaic is a great example. Passive solar is a democratic technique. Anyone can align their home or their body to the sun. You know, honeybees align their homes to face a certain direction so they get the morning sun if they have a choice. And so that's a democratic technique. Anybody can do it. Nobody can control it unless they build a skyscraper. We'll leave that aside. And on the other hand, solar photovoltaics require these huge mines in China, which are in a town called the Place Where Deer Run, which I think is a very old name. And they require mines, which require forced labor. They require people being forced off their land. They require the entire system surrounding it. This is true for anything. Like electric wires are, I don't care what you use the electricity for, it still requires this entire system of military and police to guarantee this infrastructure that surrounds it. We can talk about that later. Okay, so that's what a democratic and authoritarian technique are. And then, so we get seed saving is, subsistence farming is pretty much by definition democratic, because by definition it's subsistence and you're in your community. On the other hand, large-scale agriculture, and then we get to GMOs. You can't do, the question is, can you do it in your basement? You know, can you do it in your backyard? And you can't really do it without this other infrastructure, which means you require the whole infrastructure surrounding it. But then there's one more thing, and this is what I really want to, I guess, end with, is that authoritarian techniques are not called authoritarian techniques simply because they lead to authoritarian power structures. They're called authoritarian techniques because they end up in charge. They themselves end up being the authoritarians. Who's in charge? It's the machines. I saw this headline just a couple days ago that said, this is mainstream news. This is not, you know, some groovy eco-left news or something. It was many states facing dilemma of fracking or drinking water. And the article presented this as a reasonable question. And it actually ended by saying scientists are split on... It's like, don't these fuckers drink water? And And so that's I guess where I want to end is just by saying that these GMOs, I'll leave it to more competent hands to discuss that, but these GMOs are also authoritarian techniques, not only in that they require these huge, lovely, caring corporations like Monsanto, well, the existence of corporations, and they also, because they themselves sort of have a life of their, life is the wrong word, they have an authoritarianism all their own, and we surrender ourselves to them. And that's one of the things we'll talk about too, is how do you unsurrender? So I guess that's my intro.
Of course, is this working?
Yes.
Thank you. Incredibly difficult to follow. I might as well just follow with a sense of gratitude for you being here, being engaged in the middle of this massive urban development, suburban, peri-urban, post-urban, I don't know what it is. I tried to use the public transportation, and it's very difficult. I did get here by bus, I have to say. To all of you, thank you for being here. To the Hammer Museum, also thank you for being proactive about ideas and things that might be uncomfortable but necessary, but are necessary for our culture today. And our culture that is so incredibly centered on biology. And for a very good reason. You can mine all you want. You can run nuclear plants. And that's great for some. And you can run your nuclear plants to move water from the Klamath Knot all the way to L.A., and not even that. You can move water from Alaska to the deserts of Mexico or from the glaciers of Norway to the deserts of Africa, which are in the plants, right, for some people, to grow your food. But you have to eat. You can mine as much as you want and pull out water and pull out all kinds of other things, many nutrients. The planet has a lot left in its lithosphere, in its mineral vocation. So you can pull all that with energy. And physics has been really good at enabling this, allowing us to really believe that we can get away with human occupation of Mars and interplanetary travel where people will be fine and happy. And I think many people believe that. I used to. I have grown with the dream and then the shattering of that dream, thankfully to myself, because it has taken a lot of work through my lifetime to come out of the 50s with the promise of power packs and food out of a squeeze tube, and maybe not even eating. That promise that became, how many characters? 160 characters? What is a Twitter? 140, 100? I don't know because I don't tweet. But we came out from the possibility of a reality that was amazing to the reality of our thumbs just and our eyeballs just busy on something that has absolutely no relevance to what's going to happen in the future. It's been a fascinating ride for me as I have strived to become a biologist. And at the same time, it has been a fascinating ride to watch what biology has become and how biology, when I started, used to be just a discipline for nerds and weird people who liked bugsies and, you know, being out in the dirt and so on. A terrible, terrible word, dirt, right? To a discipline that is now much more recognized by the word, this other terrible word, technology, biotechnology. So how we've come to it, how we've come to the feeling that we could do everything and physics delivering to us all the necessary elements to maintain that belief, and finding ourselves in the beginning of the 21st century really stuck because of biology. Where the world yielded to physics and sent people off into other planets and allowed us to have cell phones that communicate through satellites and so on, where physics delivered, biology has not. And therein I find the most fascinating part of my growth as a biologist, in the realization that biology didn't yield the way physics did in the 20th century. And the 21st century most definitely is showing that biology is not doing what it was supposed to do. Because mining, as we might, we still cannot make do without the seed. We still cannot figure out what to do about the biology. There is a fantastically important myth that I really want to be clear about as a lie. It's not just a myth, but a lie. And that is the idea that if we put away all the DNA of organisms in the planet today, somebody in the future, perhaps wiser than us, will be able to reconstruct the planet in all its complexity and relationships. This is really not true. I work currently a lot with the idea of saving seeds that links up to a bunch of people, mostly physicists, mostly trained in the physical sciences, who believe that by putting DNA, so-called genes, very difficult word that one, putting DNA away under a rock in Svalbard, in the northern, close to the North Pole, we'll be fine, and we shouldn't worry. Together with our mining, and actually the interesting thing about Svalbard is that it's put in a coal mine, an old coal mine that is being used just as a hole to stash away seeds. Really the cusp of a whole pyramid of so-called gene banks, in which from the 1950s or so, again, humanity has put its trust that we could recover what we all know we're losing, the diversity of life, the diversity of seeds that we depend on. Let me tell you, it was already Jack Kloppenberg in the 60s and 70s who was saying that these so-called banks, again, an important word to pay attention to, the seed banks should be called seed morgues, because over 70% of those seeds are dead. And when you ask the people who really know, not the people who make PR and write journal articles about them, when you ask the people who really know, the farmers as well as the plant breeders, and what are we going to do with those dead seeds? And they say, I don't know. Pull out the DNA, you can do great phylogenetics with that. But then what? We have lost already something that is coming back slowly to catch up with us, and something for which we do not have the tools that physics has to deal with other problems. Again, I can imagine a world where everything looks like, what's the place, Westwood that we are in, right? Everything looks like Westwood. Out of physics, but not out of biology. Because there has to be a biology that supports Westwood. And we pretend that we can push that biology away to the Central Valley and then eventually to Africa or Mexico or wherever, but the biology has to be there, and the diversity that we depend on has to be there. And you might not see it from Westwood, you might not see it from wherever you live here, but that diversity is being lost. At the center of that whole problem are two very important words. One is the word science, and the other one is the word biology. We have conceded the discussion about this to an elite, to what is pretty much a priesthood of people who call themselves scientists, who are vetted scientists, like myself. You know, I've been through the vetting process, and I'm one of those priests. And we have removed that discussion from the public. For that reason, I think this gathering that we have here is a really, really important one, and this is why I thank the Hammer for doing this. We cannot have this kind of discussion anymore in my temples, where I practice my priesthood of being a scientist. You cannot get away with having this forum, and Vandana knows that well from Berkeley when we've tried to put that together. She was there a few weeks ago, and she had to be in a church Because that's where people are prepared to come and discuss matters that should have been discussed in the temple of science. And why are they not discussed? They're not discussed, to be brief, because long ago, but not so long ago, 1950s or so, we made a decision, we made a central decision as a society to move forward with an agenda, with a plan of progress, with a plan of forward eternal growth, frontier making, and California is the place for that. And we had very good reasons to believe that this plan would work, that we could move forward no matter what, that there were no limits. We, if nothing else, had the bomb, the nuclear bomb, to prove it. The nuclear bomb works. And at the very same time, it was the very same people who were proposing this plan of never-ending growth through so-called innovation, market creation, and economic growth that way. At the very same time, the very same people proposed that just like physics had delivered the nuclear bomb, biology was to deliver an equivalent source of continuous growth and forever never-ending frontier. It was that moment when the decision was made to stop asking uncomfortable questions and stop asking people about it and just leaving the decisions and leaving the whole policy making to this elite of priest-like people. It started with physicists, not surprising, because they were the people who were brought in. But slowly and surely, biology has been taken over by this mind frame in which we believe that by finding the indivisible unit of life, the so-called gene, or maybe the DNA base pair as the indivisible unit of life, and holding that unit of life to our rule and our control and power, we would be able to produce life from scratch. You hear in the newspapers about synthetic biology, you hear about the many waves and fantastic, amazing things of genetic engineering, but the reality is that transgenesis, that tool of genetic engineering, the bottom, the heart of genetic engineering, is already 44 years old. 1972 was the year. What is that, 42 years old? 1972 was the first year when there was a transgenic organism on the planet, up where I live in Stanford. And so it's been more than 40 years, much longer than it took to go from the concept, really, of a computer to laptops and handhelds, much longer than it took from going from the concept of the nuclear bomb to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We have had enormous amounts of time, enormous amounts of money, and the billions, you know, we've lost count. We were keeping account up to more or less the year 2000, but we have lost count of how much money, that means how much credit we have given to this idea in biology. And yet, really out there, 98% of the organisms that are released are really of two kinds. They call them two products, right? They use the word product for what genetic engineering produces. And there are only two kinds. The plants that produce insecticide themselves in every cell, pretty crazy idea, I think, and the plants that resist a herbicide being sprayed over them. Herbicide-resistant plants and insecticide-producing plants are the two products, watch me using that word, are the two manipulations that yielded to this program. Nothing else. 40 years for that. Those two interventions have been completely defeated by this time, and we can talk about the emergence of herbicide-resistant weeds, the so-called super weeds that are taking over many agricultural fields in the U.S. In the year 2012, that's where I have a number, 50% of American agricultural fields in the Corn Belt were having to struggle with super weeds. And we have the emergence of super pests because of the continuous exposure of insect populations to insecticide producing plants, an ecological truism that we knew from the beginning was going to happen, right? So they've been defeated, and there's nothing else in the pipeline. Yeah, there is talk about silk-producing goats and you name it, all kinds of things. But the reality is that life has resisted, that life has a very different set of behaviors and rules and propositions that do not match the enticement of the physicist and the engineer. And so we find ourselves discussing about this in a theater, in a museum, a cultural center and an art museum. Because the word came out down to my priesthood to shut up and move on. If it doesn't work, just throw more money, throw more time, throw more young people into it, because this is all we teach our students even to this day, is the program. Let a student question, challenge the idea of the gene, for example, and we can talk about how faulty that concept is, and he'll be out, you know, F. Let a student question the concept of the central dogma that says that everything is inside you and you have no capacity to move, to have any decision power. This is Richard Dawkins saying, we're lumbering robots doing the bidding of our genes inside us. And, you know, this determinism that is also very religious, by the way. Yeah. So we teach our students. So it doesn't work. It doesn't yield. We throw more money. We throw more time. We throw our young people into it. And I say this because I work with young people, and I'm very, very conscious and sensitive to the great sacrifice to this idea that we have done of our youth. Our public institutions, and I recognize I am speaking in a public institution. I'm speaking at UCLA in a way. So it's great. We have cracks and we have corners. But in general, our public institutions are taken over by this idea. And they were taken over the very same way that bottled water took over the world without anybody even noticing. Nobody complained. And now we're really stuck with an educational system that is compromised, an educational and a research system that is compromised from its core, from the bottom. Not only to advertise for the many different people, and I walk through some Chevron or BP or some oil company gate. Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of offensive, but not too much. Much more offensive it is to take over the field of concepts, the capacity to imagine in our young people as well as in our public spaces. So this is what I want to discuss about. I want to recover the spaces that have been lost for you, for all of us, to talk about these things, to deal with them in reality, not in some kind of dream world from the 1950s when jetpacks were available, and to see what it is to be done from here into the future, who it is that we need to support, because there are alternatives. In this mad race towards this program, we forgot about so many possibilities that I think Vandana is about to talk about. So I would like to keep this and maybe keep this post here open for that aspect of our discussion, as well as for the discussion about all the other organisms that we do not see. Because if genetic engineering is a failure, and I'm happy to talk more about that, if it is a failure, and I think it is at the same time a massive intervention out into the world, into the environment of the many, many life forms that we do not even think about. And here, perhaps, if I may have one more minute, somebody in the back could show one slide. I have one image that I want to leave with you. Is that possible? Yeah. Talk about power. This is a chart of the diversity of life as seen from the point of view of DNA. Many of those life forms, each end of each branch is a life form that exists on the planet today. And some of them are labeled with numbers, as you can see, because we don't even know what they are. They were fished out of the ocean, probably just as DNA forms. And all these DNA forms are aligned and compared in very interesting ways. This is a phylogenetic relationship network in which if you were to walk from one life form to the other, the distance between one life form and the other tells you the degree of connectedness in phylogenetic terms. I'm sorry. That means to say, how long ago did you have a common relative to that organism? I don't know if that's clear. I cannot point with my finger right here. I would need to jump or something. But you see on the left side a shaded area. Homo is the Latin name for us. You can see yourself depicted in this map. In close vicinity to your close relatives. Close relatives like Zia, and that is not a monkey. It's not a rat. It's not even a jellyfish or a worm. A jellyfish and a worm at this scale looks completely undistinguishable from you. Zia is corn. So in that little corner, Zia is all plants put together. Coprinus is a fungus. So fungi are very close relatives to us at this scale. So the intervention of genetic engineering, the intervention that this faulty biology has done on the world, is not just in the world of physical domains affecting here and Mexico and India, but at this scale, in this domain, the phylogenetic scale, it is an intervention in which we're mixing and matching in a world that you can see we have hardly begun to even measure, let alone understand. So I would like to leave with that and see if we can remember that we're talking not only about us, but about all of that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ignacio, and thank you, Derek, and thank you, of course, to the Hammer Museum and to Friends of Navdanya and to Ahe. The last time we were together was in the botanical gardens in Oaxaca, basically joining a movement of the Mexicans to defend Zia and their maize as their identity, as their culture. There was an attempt, I think it's 6 million acres Monsanto wanted to plant at a go that year with GMO maize. And the movements, not only has life resisted, people have resisted too.
We're life.
It's now 30 years since I started to focus on food and agriculture. And every passing year, it becomes clearer that the future of human freedom and the future of human existence will be determined by what we do with seed and food. Never before has human freedom been so threatened as it is being threatened today. I started to look at agriculture that time because of two very, very serious tragedies of 1984, both related to agriculture. One was the leak of from a pesticide plant in the city of Bhopal. It's the 30th anniversary this year. And the other was the emergence of violence in Punjab. I'd been following what had been happening to Punjab earlier. And basically, farmers were protesting against what they defined as a slavery system. 4th of June of 1984, they were going to blockade the supply of grain to Delhi, saying, if we can't decide what we grow, how we grow it, if we can't decide where it'll sell, we can't decide what price it'll sell at, we are living under slavery. The army was sent to the Golden Temple and a vicious cycle of violence continues even today. It hasn't gone. And I won't go into too much detail about how I see such similarity between what happened to Punjab in 1984 and what's happening to Syria today. Because, you know, all of the Middle East, their local seeds have been made illegal. Syria had one of the most important of the CG centers, ICARDA, for arid zone research. The farmers were not allowed to grow their native seeds. They were getting these improved varieties, so-called. In 2009, they had a very, very severe drought. 800,000 people were displaced. 75% crop failure, 85% livestock death. They moved to the city Dara. And because governments today are tied up with the so-called free trade treaties, which have nothing to do with freedom for people, Assad couldn't respond to their demands, because protecting your farmers is defined as protectionism in free trade, not allowed. So Assad started to throw these people in jail. And before you know it, their relatives started to get armed and the rebellion started. And now it's in absolute chaos. No one has any idea. But it began with the way agriculture had become non-sustainable and how climate change intensified the vulnerability. But you don't hear the reality of how the planet and societies are being made vulnerable, because you call them myths. The Green Revolution myth is so central to maintain an industrial agriculture system and spread it worldwide. Now, I started to look in 1984 at what was really going on and realized that it was such amazing myth-making. Basically, these were new seeds evolved to deal with chemicals, because real plants don't like chemicals. They say no. They do what Gandhi said, a satyagraha, the force of truth, they say, take the chemical away. So they modify the plant to deal with the chemical and turn them into dwarf varieties. This is what the Green Revolution was. It was maize and wheat in Mexico, and it was wheat and rice for India. And it was called a miracle. Now, science is not supposed to deal with miracles. Norman Borlaug, who was given a Nobel Peace Prize for the story that these chemicals and seeds will create prosperity and never would farmers take to the gun again and never have a violent revolt like the Red Revolt in China. And that's why it was called green. There wasn't a green movement in the 60s. They called it green because plants are green and green is different from red. Norman Borlaug sent out 12 people to spread these chemicals and seeds, and he called them his wheat apostles. Now that's religion. Recently, there was an attack on me, and they said, I have prevented Norman Borlaug from being canonized as a saint. That he'd have become a saint by now if I hadn't written that book called The Violence of the Green Revolution. And there are three tendencies in that violent system, which comes from war. Industrial chemical agriculture has its roots in war. Every chemical applied has had something to do with a war chemical in the past. Chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides. So it comes from a militarized mindset. It comes from militarized knowledge. And it brings that mindset to bear on every living thing. If you read textbooks on pest control, it's about how every insect is at war with us. Therefore, we've got to exterminate them. Every use of herbicide makes everything green look like something that's going to attack us, you know. Insects move, but plants don't even move, and yet they're treated as enemies that'll get us. So get them before they get you. Spray Roundup. And it's the logic of extermination. And that logic of extermination then doesn't stay limited to the natural world. It spills over into how we deal with society. It cultivates a monoculture. It creates an intolerance of diversity. We used to eat 8,500 plants, species. And now what's grown most of the places in the world for trading globally is 8. And when you add to it the genetically modified expansion, which is the fastest expansion with the two traits that Ignacio mentioned, We are talking about four crops: corn, soya, canola, cotton. Can you imagine how much diversity we've destroyed? And we've destroyed it because not only does the extermination of diversity bring control, it brings profits. Because what ecosystems with diversity can do for themselves in self-organized freedom is now dependent on an external input. Soil fertility can be beautifully renewed with growing organic matter and returning it to the soil by growing beans and dals, which fix the nitrogen, by growing green manures. We have a farm where we grow more than 1,000 varieties of crops. And when we started, there used to be a few pests, and we would use natural agents like neem. Today, there are no pests. There are so many beneficial insects flourishing. Spiders on every wheat plant, the ladybird, which controls the aphid. And they're doing a GM trial in England to have a genetically modified wheat that would control aphids, when all you need is to give space to the ladybirds. And the interesting thing is they talk about adding a cow-like gene. And to date, I don't know what this cow-like gene is about, where it comes from and why it's cow-like and not cow. Now, beginning with the 1984 wake-up on the violence of this industrial system, I was introduced to the monopolies that were being sought in a meeting in 1987. At that time, the old chemical industry was coming out as the new life sciences industry. They didn't have any commercial crop at that time, but they were looking into the future. And at this meeting, which was held by the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation in Geneva and Beaujiv, they said very honestly, we have to do genetic engineering because the only way we can claim patents. And patents mean a claim to invention. It also means ownership. It means preventing anyone else from having access to what's patented. For seed, it means defining a farmer who saves seed as an intellectual property thief. Worse, it defines a farmer whose field is contaminated with a GM crop as an intellectual property thief. This is what happened to Percy Smyser in Canada. It's happened to more than 1,500 farmers in this country who have been sued. And they went further and said, we've got to have a global treaty to make sure these patents are implemented worldwide. That's what became the World Trade Organization Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. I heard this, and you know, my worldview is a worldview, exactly the worldview that Ignacio showed with in that very interesting way that is beyond my understanding, except the interconnectedness and our closeness, that all beings on this planet are our relatives, and we are part of the Earth family. That's the worldview I've grown up with, and the idea that some corporations are now coming up and saying, we've invented the plants, we've invented the seed, and they're our property, and farmers will be criminalized for seed saving, for me was absolutely unacceptable. So I decided on my way back home from Geneva, the rest of my life I will save seeds. I had to teach myself how to do it. But the good thing is, when you are not that deterministic sort of entity where the master molecules and the central dogma have fixed you, actually we evolve. Pests evolve, can become super pests. Weeds evolve, they can become super weeds. We all evolve and we learn. In these 30 years, what we've learned is, A, there's nothing like an inferior seed, just like there's no inferior culture, just like there's no inferior species, and now there's no inferior gender. Those are all imposed categories. We work with native seeds, and we grow more food than all the high-yielding varieties and all the GMOs. There's only one legally approved GMO. It started out illegally. That's why I sued Monsanto in 99. They came in without any permission. The only crop that's legally allowed in India is one of those HTBTs. It's the BT cotton. And the advertising for this was it's going to give 1,500 kilograms per acre. There's going to be no pests ever. What they didn't let people know is that the cost of the seed would jump 17,000%. What they didn't let people know is that mechanistic idea of control doesn't work. That not only has the bollworm become resistant, new pests have been created. Species that were never pests of cotton. And farmers are having to spend more money. So they're spending more on the seed, which has to be bought every year. Not just bought once every year, sometimes three times, sometimes four times every year, because it's not adapted. It hasn't evolved. And it fails. There's a drought, it fails. There's too much rain, it fails. There's too many new pests, it fails. So farmers in India are getting into such deep debt that we have something we've never known in resilient India, where we believed in incarnation, and we believe there's another life where we can sort it all out. You know, things didn't go well now, there's another life, and another, and another, and another. There's never a final book. But when the agents of the seed companies come to collect your land, you don't wait for your next life. And so farmers are committing suicide. 291,000, according to government statistics. Most of them are in the cotton belt. So the idea that this is the miracle that's going to save the world, it's not working as a tool or a technology. It's not working for society. It is, in fact, the only way GMOs can spread is through deepening dictatorship. You quoted Dawkins about loops and, you know, controlling loops at command. The problem is all those species don't listen to the commands. And we've done a report of Navdanya. It's called "The GMO Emperor Has No Clothes." Remember, it took a little child to recognize the emperor was naked. And this emperor is very, very, very naked. But there is, of course, the issue of controlling people, controlling society. You can't control the planet. You can't control all species. But you can control society if society doesn't commit itself to stay free. We've worked over these 30 years to make sure we don't allow laws that prevent us from saving our seeds. In 1993, I think we organized a big rally of 500,000 farmers to make a commitment. We will not obey these laws, even if they're put in place. We will continue to save seeds. Navdanya, the movement, has spread more than 750,000 farmers. Our commitment is we've received these seeds from the earth and our ancestors. We owe it to the future to pass them on in diversity and integrity. We will not obey any law that comes in the way of our higher freedom, our higher ecological duty, and our higher ethical duties. Now, just in this country, in the last few weeks, you've seen two more ballot initiatives on labeling defeated. Now, the right to know is part of freedom to know what you're eating. Yeah? And to be denied that right just because millions can be poured. And those millions have come from where? They've come from stealing from the farmers. They've come from making people pay huge amounts of money for toxic drinks. The labeling initiatives have been defeated not by a democratic vote, but by the power of money. Vermont managed to get a labeling initiative through, and Claudio announced that they are now being sued. And this is something fascinating that we have to address. Suddenly in this country, there's a new myth being created that legal entities to whom we give permission to exist, which were businesses, which became bigger and then they became corporations, they're now saying they are persons. Yeah? And that their power to influence with money is free speech. Now, corporations are not persons. They're not living beings. And bullying with money is not freedom of speech. It takes away people's freedom of speech. LA is now a GMO-free LA. Yeah? And while you clap, you'd better be prepared to get into a really long fight. Because the laws we stopped in India by declaring civil disobedience, the seed satyagraha, the fight for truth, we stopped those laws. In the same year, 2004, must have been a very big year for governments getting together with the biotech industry. Because they couldn't control the seed through patents, because most countries are GMO-free. Most crops are GMO-free. And the organic movement is growing so fast. The seed-saving movement is growing so fast. Their new strategy is make it criminal to have your own seeds. So two seed libraries, one in Pennsylvania and one in Maryland, have been served notices under the seed law of 2004 that declare seed saving as an agri-terrorism act. The law doesn't say agri-terrorism. The law doesn't say agri-terrorism. It's the inspectors who came to the library. Little library, not even a big seed bank. So we're either going to have seed freedom and food freedom, and that won't happen automatically. It'll take a lot of courage, and it'll take a lot of creativity, and it'll take a lot of work, and it'll take a lot of solidarity. Or we're going to have a dictatorship, which in the case of life itself means extinction. It's dictatorship over food and seed will fail anyway. It can't work, but it can destroy the future, both for many species as well as our own. So I don't think humanity has faced the challenge we face today, ecologically, ethically, politically, or in terms of the very basis of our lives, the food we eat. And it's no more one country's challenge. We are all interconnected in this challenge, and we are interconnected in the solutions. And I know the solutions are in our hands, and we can find a way that is not the path to dictatorship leading to extinction. Thank you. We have some time. No, we don't. I think she should. We do? Yeah?
You can see we don't know exactly what we're doing, so... You should take over if you can.
Can someone answer the question?
Do you want to go to Q&A?
Yeah.
Okay. Can someone answer the question about the biodiversity of plants and the effect on the future generations of constitution of health of every person to resist disease and just generally grow up healthy?
So before we go to that, I'm sorry, let me interrupt for one moment. We were going to have a little colloquy, but I think we're going to go straight to Q&A. A few house rules on Q&A. Please keep your questions brief. Please keep them as questions. And please direct them at our specific guest speakers. That would be really wonderful. So we have one question from the front row. Do we have our ushers with microphones ready? Thank you.
Hello. I'm going to restate my question. So on the biodiversity of plants and the nutritional value that basically sets up your constitution as you eat your diverse food palette. How is that going to affect future generations as well as now of how we defend our own bodies against all the viruses and bacteria since it's not being grown, you know, with biodiversity?
Well, three issues related to the issue of biodiversity and our health. The logic of extermination that has destroyed biodiversity to create industrial monocultures was done in the name of increasing food production. It's actually decreased food production per acre. And Navdanya's work of saving seeds and intensifying biodiversity shows that we actually grow more nutrition per acre. We have a report. It's available on our website, Navdanya, NAVDANYA.org, where we show that nutrition per acre increases dramatically. Second issue is related to the fact that as that extermination model has destroyed biodiversity, They're now coming up to save the story of GMOs, which are a failure when you look at BT and HT. They're coming up with this idea of biofortification, a golden rice that'll have vitamin A. It's 100% less efficient than available alternatives that produce good vitamin A. A GMO banana, which will produce more iron and more vitamin A. On iron, we did a study on comparing iron-rich sources, which have been killed with herbicides and Roundup. 7,000% more iron availability if we grow diversity, and there are kitchen gardens everywhere, and there are gardens everywhere. That's the solution. The GMO banana turns out it's pirated. And not just pirated, they're doing trials with 12 students. That's a scientific experiment. 12 students will eat three GMO bananas in the Iowa State University. Why in Iowa State University? Because then they can tell the Africans, well, we've tested it in America and Americans ate it. 12 Americans will have eaten it because they're getting $900 each, the students. So that's the kind of scam the GMO end of it. Currently, a study was done independently, and this I'll give this very quickly. The glyphosate levels in GMO corn are 13 parts per million, zero in non-GMO corn. Formaldehyde, which is a big issue that's now being investigated, formaldehyde is building up in GMO corn, 200 parts per million. Meantime, the beneficial minerals are disappearing. Calcium is only 14 compared to 6,000. Magnesium is 2 compared to 113. So the disappearance of biodiversity, increase of monocultures, and then genetic modification added to it is, on the one hand, taking away from our diets the vital nutrients we need and adding toxic. So it's a double harm to our health. And I really do feel the connection between biodiversity and health needs to be made much more. And the health movement, the environment movement, and the democracy movement need to become one movement.
Before we go to another person, I want to add to that question to talk about the sort of more recent in the past year discovery of the microgenome in the gut and how important that is for human nutrition and how some of these issues might be related to that.
Yeah, I think this question is a great one because, and I wish that our universities all had, no, our kindergartens all had, and the whole educational system had this question as a centerpiece of our syllabi and so on. We do not have that. So we don't have enough time to deal with your question, of course, but it's important to recognize which of the many different lectures in that whole kindergarten through graduate student would I choose to teach. Maybe I would start with dealing with another myth of the 50s, which was that food pyramid that we still use. As if all we're doing by relating to plants through our mouths was eating, and all we were doing through eating was acquiring five different things, right? The carbohydrates and the, I don't know, fibers and vitamins and minerals. I don't know what they are in the pyramid. I think you formulated your question in a really interesting way by almost saying the very important statement, you are what you eat. And in what way the loss of diversity affects what you are is an obvious question to ask. And I just want to let you know of a really important piece of research that you will not hear anywhere else, I think, because we do not know how to deal with it and because it doesn't fit in the program. But it's already about 3 years old. Excellent piece of work, many, many years in the making, many, many groups and so on, who demonstrate with people who eat rice, people who have eaten rice for many generations, this means China, and they demonstrate that the rice plant has a message written, if you will, we need to fall back on very quick language. So written in the language of microRNA. It's not DNA, so by default, the central dogma people don't know what to do with it. So there's microRNA in the rice plant that comes as a message that travels through the gut lining, goes into the bloodstream, and has, once it has been transferred into the bloodstream in these microvesicles, the microvesicle has on the surface an address to different organs in the body of people who eat rice. And this microvesicle travels through the bloodstream, finds the organ, delivers the message that rice sent. This is written by rice, enveloped by the human gut and sent to different organs. And controls, they demonstrated that at least it controls cholesterol metabolism. And but they also demonstrate that there are many other organs that have receptors for this same address. So that means that this message is being heard in different ways, translated in different manners by different organs in the human body. So you are what you eat doesn't mean just the starch and the minerals and the vitamins. It means a huge amount more. And what you are really is a relationship with your ecosystem by eating. You relate to that ecosystem in many more ways than just the acquiring of the stuff that you're made of. What we lose with diversity.
I want to say something about that too.
Okay, quick response from Derek, and obviously also there's things we just don't know about yet.
Which is really what I was going to say. That I think the question is, do we know better how to manage our bodies, or do our bodies know better how to manage our bodies? And is there knowledge in our bodies and in our larger natural communities? Does nature know better, or do humans by themselves through science know better? And a quick thing about that is that I have Crohn's disease, and that's a disease that goes up as soon as a place industrializes. And one of the most current theories as to one of the reasons it happens is because of increased hygiene. It ends up that people who have whipworms often don't have any number of autoimmune disorders. And I actually take whipworms. And it ends up that the whipworms modulate your immune system because they don't want to get attacked by your immune system. And so my question is, if we can't even... who would guess the relationship between whipworms and Crohn's disease or asthma? It's nuts. And so my point is that it's exactly that. We evolved in place, and nature knows best.
All right, we're going to take a question from this side of the audience. There's a gentleman with glasses.
I just wanted to ask you, you had mentioned the banana earlier and the GMO bananas. What do you think about the destruction of the Cavendish species of banana that actually replaced the Gros Michel species that collapsed about 50 years ago? Like, the banana of our grandparents is not the banana that we know, and the Cavendish that we now know is dying of Panama disease because... each banana plant in the world right now that's being cultivated is an exact clone of every other banana plant. So you end up with a calamity when any microbe or any organism comes in and actually destroys that plant. So I just wonder what you thought about, instantaneous global collapse of food crops like bananas and how the lack of diversity affects that.
Well, 2 points. The whole world doesn't grow Cavendish. In India, we grow a lot of diversity of bananas. I think we still grow about 150. We used to have thousands. India is the largest producer of bananas and the largest eater of bananas, but it's the insignificant trader in bananas. We grow bananas and eat locally. The second biggest country for producing and eating bananas is Uganda, and Uganda's staple is banana. They don't eat rice, they don't eat corn, they don't eat wheat, they eat banana. Morning, noon, night, in every form. And there too, there's a lot of diversity. And that's why these 2 countries are being targeted with the GMO banana, which will not just be GMO, but it'll bring those monocultures in with it. And monocultures are ready-made recipes for attracting disease and pests and collapse. So biodiversity is the immunity not just of our bodies, but the immunity of the planet. And that's why we have to bring biodiversity back into agriculture. Biodiversity is intolerant with systems that are based on control. That's why local food systems and biodiversity go hand in hand. Decentralization and diversity go hand in hand. And this is not a luxury. It was presented as a luxury. This is not a luxury anymore. The luxury is saying, let's grow Cavendish and let it collapse. Let's grow one kind of corn and let it collapse. Monsanto is now scavenging the world for soya. And it's taken a patent on scavenging for soya. You know, on the search for soya beans, because they have such narrow base in the GM soya, they know it's going to collapse. So they have a patent for collecting soya beans around the world. And we have a big campaign on no patents on these varieties that they're trying to get. So yes, monocultures are an absolute threat to the future and can collapse like that.
Let's take a question from that side of the room. Someone has their hand up there in the fourth row. So wait for the microphone, please.
Vandana, how do we help support these kinds of campaigns that you're brewing in India and make them global?
Well, I'm going to ask Kumkum to say how it can be supported. Kumkum, can you inform? Supporting.
We're going to bring you a microphone.
Well, you know, Kumkum has started a 501c3 here called Friends of Navdanya. And one way you can support is by contributing, because then everything supports our work. And our work on the ground is creating seed banks. We've created 120. We call them banks because we bank on them, not because they are Wall Street. And, you know, we started these banks long before the Wall Street scandal. The reason you call them seed libraries is because it was post 2000.
You managed to bring the imagery of the bank to where it comes from, which is a guy sitting in a bank out on the street lending out and receiving. then I'm with you.
Yeah, no, these are communities.
But we really need to rethink this word.
We really need to rethink this word. But basically, putting seed in the hands of community, putting seeds in the hands of farmers. And another myth is that farmers' seeds are static. And the new seeds bred by industry are improved and dynamic. Traditional seeds evolve. And we do participatory breeding and evolutionary breeding. And those seeds are the seeds that have allowed us to face every climate disaster and have increased the nutrition availability. We are helping farmers go organic. We are helping 5 states of India go organic. I'm helping Bhutan become 100% organic state. And then, of course, we help farmers create these decentralized and fair and just markets. So you can help in all of it by contributing to Friends of Navdanya. And I'm sure Kumkum later, you can, you know, when we go out to do book signing, we can talk more about it.
Might I also add, it might be good to learn something about basic biology and genetics. People on this side of the room, please. Do we have any questions on this side of the room? Oh, there we go. Young person question.
In simple words, if I could just ask you to give a message to the great-grandchildren of my child in the future, which your efforts and your legacy are going to be very worthwhile, what would you impart with them?
Well, I want to put all the seeds of the world in children's hands. Let them have gardens. Let them create seed sanctuaries, not in Svalbard, but in children's hands everywhere.
Ignacio and Derek, do you want to say anything?
I'm sorry, but what comes to mind, I was glad not to have to answer the question.
You don't have to answer.
But because what immediately comes up on me is what I feel like saying my daughter, not only future generations, and it's, I'm sorry. You know, sorry I didn't do more. Sorry I didn't put myself, I don't know. Sorry I couldn't figure out what it took. You know, run naked somewhere important or what? I don't know. So I just think they will be living in a very different world. That is for sure. And I believe that that world is going to be much more diverse than what we have. I really do believe that we're going through a huge bottleneck right now that just cannot give too much more. And so I think it's going to be, they will be less stressed than we are. That's my guess. I don't know. I think I'm kind of prodding you to give an answer. Sorry, I couldn't do more.
Derek, are you passing?
No, I can't. I was so glad you gave your answer, and then I was just going to say I'm sorry too, except then you got optimistic on us. And
why not?
I think that it's like a friend of mine always says, things are going to get worse before they get worse. And I think that part of the problem is that there's two big problems. One of them is that the dominant culture is sociopathological, and unless it stopped, it will kill everything on the planet. And that's half the problem is them, and the other half of the problem is us. And by which I don't mean, oh, because we participate in the system, because so many indigenous people have said to me, it's like, don't take responsibility for car culture. You know, you didn't create car culture. It's your job to destroy car culture. It's not because you drive a car. In the 1980s was the first time that the corporate press called human beings consumers more often than it called them citizens. And that's a huge transformation that we should not allow, because if you're a consumer, your choices are buy and don't buy. If you're a citizen, your choices are buy, don't buy, organize, boycott, resist, and when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right, or I would say responsibility of the people to alter or abolish it. And there's another transition that is even deeper, which is several thousand years ago, we were converted from human animals who need habitat and community to citizens. And I think we need to remember that we're animals and who need habitat. So that's where I think our problem is. It's not because we participate in the system. Big deal that it's difficult for you. Don't blame yourself. I'm not saying you did blame yourself, but don't blame yourself because it's hard to get around in public transportation in L.A. It's not your fault. And that's one of the things they do is try to convince us it's all our fault. And it's not our fault. But the way we do buy into it is what Lewis Mumford called a magnificent bribe, which is in exchange for accepting the system, we get all the goodies that it gives us in exchange for giving up the rest of the world. And the bribe is that we accept that deal and we don't decolonize. But back to what I would say to... Well, here's what I would love to say to children from two generations and from now, which is, we did it. We stopped the damn machine before it killed everything. Well, the question is how we did it. That's where it gets a little bit. I'll leave that for the other people.
All right, we're going to take a question from this side of the room. I see somebody right in the second to last row there in the corner.
Thank you for your work. It's amazing. You mentioned that your nonprofit organization is on banking seeds, but is it as important for us to collaborate with all the other organizations that are working on the same mission, the Food Watch, EWR, and things like that, so that we can actually escalate from where we are now, because it's such a fragile state of affairs that's going on with how strong the impact is with the GMOs, that we actually try to really, all of us that are in this room, work harder in making sure that we share the information that you're giving us and have a big musical festival or something and just teach the children. You know, this is so incredible that we...
Well, I think
what all three of us have said is that it's all about relationships and connecting. And that's true in nature, and it's true in political organizing. The silo period of organizing is over. It's going to have no impact. The solidarity period of organizing has just begun. And what we can do for transformation through that is the possibility that two generations down, we can say we did it.
I want to say one thing to that, which is I just recently interviewed Kathleen Dean Moore, and she said this beautiful thing that I've become an apostle for Kathleen Dean Moore. I asked her, what can one person do? And she gave the best answer ever, which is, don't be one person.
Speaking of expanding the message, there are so many films out right now that deal with a lot of the issues we've been talking about today. Do you three have any favorites that you recommend? Loaded question. Okay, we'll take another question from the audience.
It's not so much a loaded question as the fact that, you know, I don't get to see them too often.
Okay. Well, you're in probably half of them, but at least half. We're going to take a question from this side of the room then. Anyone on this side of the room have a question? Well, there's no questions on that side of the room, so now we're going to go back to that side of the room. There's a woman there in the fourth row next to the pink shirt.
I've been working as an activist for the past 32 years. When we first started experiencing the E. coli 0157H7 bacteria in this country, I never saw a pathogen that could kill people in such a short amount of time, even though I grew up around food, in restaurants, around farms, around gardens. Being a sole proprietor of a business, it terrified me to think that that could happen to one of my patrons. So I spent countless hours, thousands of documents, all from science and our own government, now classified as confidential business information that we're no longer privy to. The bacteria by Mei-Wan Ho and other international scientists has been determined to have caused, is a new and emerging infectious disease that just started at the advent of genetic engineering. Probably a week or a month doesn't go by where we see epidemic outbreaks where children are dying, basically melts down their internal organs. This is a bacteria that before genetic engineering took hold, scientists and consortium said that the biggest fear of genetic engineering would be that E. coli would become pathogenic. Well, it has, and we're not doing anything about it. And if you take infectious diseases, line that up with field releases, line that up with parts of this country who had the most releases, you'll see it's clear. Where the releases are taking place is where the pathogens are happening. Roslin Institute in Scotland that are cloning animals right and left, same place, same thing. So we're cloning and we're using our own bacteria. And like Derek said, if a jellyfish wanted to mate, well, it's not mating. The jellyfish would have to shit on the pig, and then you'd have to throw tons of viruses on top of it to make something transcribe there.
So, Ignacio, you are the microbiologist. Can you make that connection between the recent bacteria outbreaks and GMOs?
They're not recent. They've been happening since 1982.
But, I mean, there has been a very recent ultra rash of them happening.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I think you're right that it's kind of crazy that we would use those organisms that are most easily grown and most easily grown in our own guts to play with. I completely agree with you. What I find most tragic about what you described is the fact that we cannot know. That we were denied even the possibility of discussing whether this was something that we as a public, as humanity, wanted to go into. There's 1972, the Asilomar Conference, where scientists or the anointed scientists got together in Asilomar for a little while. They called a moratorium on genetic engineering. And the moratorium lasted a few months. The way they ended the moratorium, because they all went really worried that all these opportunities, possibilities, and promises would stay in the drawing board, they said, oh, all these propositions, all these proposals we're doing with microbes that we keep in the lab. So as long as we keep microbes in the lab, there will be no problem. So moratorium is lifted. Never again have we visited again that question, the question of what happens when we release an organism into the environment. I say that as having been a member of the National Academy of Sciences Committee on the environmental consequences of the release of genetically engineered crops. And I can tell you that there is just no study, no evidence, and no possibility of doing that. And to me, this is the most important point, that we have, as a public, you guys have no way of questioning what we do, no way of even knowing what we're doing until it finds itself in your gut or somewhere else. And even then, when it's growing in you, you won't even know that it came from my lab, because there is no possibility of connecting those. And I think that is an incredibly dangerous, let alone damaging situation. It's possible that people want to take the bargain. I can imagine a humanity, a crazy humanity, that says, okay, yeah, we'll have, I don't know, an increase in, I don't know, 10% of humanity will die from this. It's okay, because we like it. I mean, take the increase in cancer rates. Take the increase in autism. Take the increase in autoimmune diseases. Take the increase in all kinds of things that we take for granted and we accept as plastic bottle. Yeah, that's right. So I think the problem is not a problem of biology. It's a problem of public access and public decision-making, that we have forgotten what it was to make decisions as a group, as us. And we have allowed a very, very small group of people to make decisions as them, for us, everyone.
And I'm going to once again, because I was trained as a scientist, put a plug in for basic science education for all of you in the room, because most people don't actually understand how these genes are migrating out of the lab and into the food supply. We probably only have time for one or maybe two more questions, but I want to reiterate that following this program, we're going to go out into the courtyard. We have books for sale, and Vandana Shiva and Derek Jensen will be signing books, and I'm hoping Ignacio Chapela stays around and can talk to people out there as well. So the conversation will continue.
May I say something?
Go ahead.
I think you should have been on the program. And I want to thank you for doing such a great emceeing for this. Thank you.
Well, thank you. All right, do we have a question on this side of the room now? There's a young woman back there. Green sweater. Okay.
Taking the turn on to education, we come from an environmental charter high school where we have a class called Green Ambassadors and we learn about all of these issues. So, like, what would you think that we would need to place on the school curriculum for us as young people to learn and be able to do things and do solutions?
Okay, I just want to say that is a fantastic question. And what tiny, 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 tiny little bit of optimism I have for the future comes because you are a young person asking that question. So I want to thank you for allowing me to not so acutely feel the despair for probably at least the next 10 minutes. My answer to that would be, I would love to see classes in history of science, so people understand that it is the relationship between capitalism and science. And so people understand that it is not some, that it's not simply, it, I mean, frankly, I think that science is just the next evolution of Christianity, where you have, wow, that's really cool to be able to say that and have people in the audience respond positively. I have been chased down the street for saying that.
I'm going to come after you on this.
So history of science, including critiques of science. And, oh, how about a history of place so that everybody in this room knows that this land belongs to the Tongva? And an ecological history of the place, and also a current history. Something that my mom suggested I do, one of the smartest things ever, was I was worried because it was December and the frogs weren't singing yet. So I started keeping a calendar of every year when I first hear the frogs, or when I, you know, I see bears all the time, so I don't write down the bears anymore because I see them like every day. So when the frogs first start singing, when they quit singing, when I see this type of newt, when I see this, it's just a little very, very easy little diary. And the point is that there's this thing called declining baselines, which is where you don't realize that things are getting worse because you haven't really been paying attention. And so you come to accept GMOs. You come to accept nanotechnology. You come to accept the lack of democracy. You come to accept that there aren't any little blue butterflies anymore. And when I first moved to Crescent City 15 years ago, there were hundreds of little blue butterflies, and they're all gone. And so I think I would have classes where people actually pay attention to what there is in their neighborhood. I've recently noticed that the sow bugs are disappearing where I live. Sow bugs, for crying out loud. But the point is, you have to pay attention before you can get a baseline. And so I would have classes in the history of science and history of critiques of science, local history. I would do history of this culture so you recognize the larger picture. I'm sorry to go on, but for crying out loud, they say one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. Well, I'm going to lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize in less than 6,000 years. Which is the first myth of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq. It was a cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. And the Near East was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. Italy was heavily forested. Aristotle, Socrates, all those dead guys, they all complained that deforestation was harming water quality. And I have no doubt that the Greek Department of Environmental Quality told them, we need to study this for a few years and make sure there's really a correlation. And so I would like to see some histories of, ecological histories of, like, were there birds that were so thick? What was it like here? What was it like here 300 years ago? What was it like when there were actually rivers? So I would like to see those classes and,
nutrition.
Sure. And nutrition. And that's, okay.
So you know, one of the things we are doing in Navdanya is starting Gardens of Hope in schools, which are both allowing young people to actually realize they're part of the earth and that they are not consumers but growers of things and savers of seed. Most importantly, every lesson can be taught in that garden. You learn how to multiply by seeing one seed became 1,000. That's multiplication. Capillary action. You can learn your physics and your math, and the real place for learning biology should be those gardens and not the labs.
Gardens of hope sounds like one word too many, because you could have it either way, right? A garden is hope and hope is gardens. So, yeah. But I want to go to the actual question there, because I remember observing the United States in the 80s, can you imagine how old I am? Watching the transformation of the syllabi to take away three really important things, or three things. Biology, real biology, geography, real geography, and history. And if you think about it, what those disciplines give you is the capacity to understand yourself in relationship to others. And so this drive towards, you know, self-congratulating centeredness, self-centeredness that the U.S. has really gone into as a tunnel, is something that is affecting, I can see, I actually saw the wave of students coming through Berkeley with this change. And it was a very clear decision to stop doing that, to stop connecting us with the world. And that's really what we're suffering from. So I want to just echo the idea that history is really the important way of looking at the world, as well as geography. The way I teach my, if I may, my environmental, my introductory environmental biology course is by walking into the room and throwing fruits and vegetables at the students from a big box. And they sit in a room like this, that has higher and lower seats. And I throw apples and oranges and corn cobs mostly, so big things they can hold in their hand, like hand fruit. And then I make them stand up, and the people in front have put their hands up like that, and the people above, they have to drop the fruit at a given moment, right? So we train, we sing so that we can time perfectly. And you drop at a given moment, and you know, after the third time, we get it right. The whole room is dropping and receiving at exactly the same time, demonstrating a very important principle, right, that of the gravity, that these objects will accelerate at the same rate. And it's a very beautiful way of demonstrating gravity and demonstrating at the same time, very quickly, that biology is not physics. Because an apple or an orange or a corn cob will fall at the same rate here or in China today or in 1,000 years, more or less. But the fate of that apple, orange, or corn cob is completely different. So biology is a historical discipline. The difference between physics and biology is that biology is a historical discipline. And so denying the historicity and the geographical placing of our thinking and our questioning is the great sin that we have committed against our young people. And we should redress that.
So we need to wrap up the Q&A, but I want to give Dr. Shiva an opportunity. Do you have last words you want to wrap up today's program with?
I was actually thinking while you were talking, you know, in quantum theory, there is history. And particles remember. And that's, I think the point is not only that biology is trying to imitate physics, but it's trying to imitate a mechanical philosophy of 100 years ago that is over. And it's being imposed with a lot of violence, intellectual violence against those who would know better. Other cultures within science, as well as violence against the earth, violence against our bodies. And I really feel that we owe it to future generations to allow them to unfold both as beings as well as intellectual beings in an ecological world, in an interconnected world. Because I think the mechanistic worldview shuts out so much. And is what allows us to fit into that culture of bribing, that in the name of convenience, we accept poisons. And I want to end with a beautiful quote from Gandhi's little book on freedom, which we teach every year in a course we run. I mean, we run a course on A to Z of agroecology, a course on Gandhi and globalization. And Gandhi's little book says, when someone, you know, he's done it as question and answer, and he's saying, you know, so, but it doesn't this civilization bring progress? And he says, well, all it offers is bodily comfort, and it fails miserably even in offering that.
Well, please join me in thanking our wonderful guests.